Good. Well, Frank, as you'll agree, is a difficult act to follow. He's covered ground very well and even pinched my best picture. One thing he did do beforehand, well, I think it's always good at these really house occasions to find oneself reading something one wouldn't otherwise have read, and this applied to me just to show I've done a bit of work on and in terms of two books which have helped me to see what I wanted to say. The first was Spreading the Word, which is Simon Blackburn, specifically Groundings in the Philosophy of Language, which is, I think, an admirable book because he doesn't just survey other people's ideas, but does tackle the individual problems for himself and tells you when he doesn't think he's solved them completely. So it's an enjoyable book to read. And on page 3, I think, he has a preliminary map, which is this, and the first one in your handout, A, which is obviously very straightforward. There are three points to his triangle: speaker, language, and world. And that, I think, doesn't get us very far. Indeed, I found myself wanting to transpose it a bit and produce A prime, which is the same three points: speaker, language, and world, but emphasizing the difference or the oddity of the direct link between speaker and world, because you have to think here of the sort of connection between what's out there and the individual that doesn't depend on language, a pre-linguistic baby or an animal which doesn't have any capacity to communicate still has some links with the world. And focusing on that, I suppose, is what got the British empiricists going, the idea of direct sense impressions of what you could perceive without any intervention of language, concepts, learning, other than the plain instinctive relationships that any baby, any pigeon might achieve. And there is a thinness about that which is fairly obvious. Indeed, there's more to say than that, I think, because in our ordinary perception of the world, as the Gestalt psychologists were pointing out in the 19th century and Wittgenstein was picking up in his Seeing As, in our ordinary perception of the world, we see things as we interpret them. We see the duck as a duck in that silly duck rabbit diagram while we're thinking of it as a duck. It looks like a duck. And then when we see it, when we think of it as a rabbit, it suddenly looks different. It looks like a rabbit. And that sense that the concepts we are operating with influence, affect rather radically how we link with the world of experience, I think is important. And it is, of course, designed to emphasize that language doesn't just sit in a triangle, but it sits right in the middle of this bottom line in how we are interpreting what we experience. There's a quote from Simon Blackburn's book in the handout, which he says, rather than just having an intuitive distinction between experience, the raw, uninterpreted presentation, and judgments we make in the light of that, our conceptual powers themselves infuse and condition the experience. Interpretation goes into the making of the experience, and since that is so, his nice analogy, experience can no more be a judgment independent source of acquaintance with facts than dough can be a flour independent source of bread. I rather like that slogan, but anyway, it's a view that I think is worth emphasizing a bit, that our experience of the world is mediated by concepts, and we learn to apply and use concepts by use of language. That's the bottom line. But there is something fairly evidently missing in this diagram. I was going to ask you to guess what it might be, but Frank's already has the diagram which succeeds it, which is the other way up, I think, from his. But it brings me to the second book I mentioned as my claimed virtue, having read, which was won by a German philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, Frank has already mentioned. And I thought I ought to be reading something by a continental philosopher, because I knew I was going to be rude about continental philosophy at some point. and it is written in German, translated by an American. Therefore, to say it's not easy to read would be an understatement. Nonetheless, when I got to page 57, there in the middle was a diagram which he attributes actually to another philosopher in 1934, and I don't know anything about him, Karl Bühler. But it was in rather nice, heavy Bauhaus lines, essentially this diagram, putting, with two differences from the one I just had of Simon Blackburn's. He's leaving out the link between speaker and world, the direct link which I was making derogatory remarks about. But even more important, he has offered us a fourth point, the hearer here, which brings it back to Frank's diagram, and seems to be an absolutely vital addition to understand how language operates. It must be a peculiar thing to philosophers that they even start to draw maps of language with only speaker and language and world and no one listening, thinking for themselves and talking to themselves and writing words to sort out what they think may be an activity that philosophers do, but even they must presumably expect that some of them will listen to their lectures and some of them will read their articles. So clearly communication has two people involved, a speaker through language to the hearer. Now Frank has taken this discussion on into theory of meaning, as Habermas does, and I think it's very interesting and would be well worth discussing this afternoon, but it would be a digression from the main thing I want to talk about, which is, as the sheet says, is the key role of language in philosophy. And so I'm not going to say any more about that, but I do commend it as a framework on which theory of meaning can be built up. But I want to talk, though, as I said, about how language has to be handled in the context of philosophy, and that makes one start by wondering what is this philosophy supposed to be. And there are no satisfactory definitions of philosophy. It used to be said that philosophy is what philosophers do, which is all right as far as it goes. But I was going to try a tendentious definition that broadly the job of philosophy is to try to work out how best to describe reality, what exists, what there is out there. But it can't just be a literal description, one thing after another, a sort of infinite array of specific facts. Tractatus, atomic facts and atomic propositions could go on indefinitely, but that wouldn't be philosophy. The point is about philosophy, it's trying to provide some very general description of how things are, about either reality as a whole or some very general feature of reality. That's as far as I'll go, but I am using that, as I said, tendentiously to suggest that it is about trying to describe all that, and so by definition it's about using language and consciously using language and being aware of how the language one uses is operating. We all know the history, the crude history of starting with natural philosophy, which Aristotle could do, which is all about everything. And then the empirical sciences were spun off as activities in their own right. And this left philosophy, after all the empirical stuff had gone, on its own to do something different. And that does raise the question where, on that view of what's left of philosophy, where do philosophers get their authority? How does one determine, how does one judge whether a philosopher has got it right, whether one school of philosophy is better or worse than another? And that question of what philosophy can rely on seems to me absolutely central, hard to answer, of course. But it is what I think is worth focusing on, at least I want to talk about. And my thesis is that the only anchor to reality, to what's out there, that philosophers can claim is the analysis of concepts, which is trying to discover how words operate to describe reality, how the speaker makes the language link with the world. Now, I suspect that is a rather, as I've said, tendentious, perhaps extreme position, and it may sound like logical positivism, echoes of language, truth, and logic, which is sort of where I came into philosophy, but it does seem to me, at least we ought to look at it and see where it is inadequate. I have to say straight away that I'm very aware how negative and arid it can sound to say that philosophy is just about words. It sounds like a branch of philology, which is not what we went into philosophy to do. Indeed, if I'm allowed to be autobiographical a bit, when I was doing a BPhil here, my supervisor was Austin, and every time I suggested a subject for this baby thesis that I was supposed to do, he would say, "Too wide," and it began to dawn on me that he wasn't really interested in the philosophical questions as much as a sort of language mapping, which he wanted all his graduate students to be doing in odd corners of the linguistic field. And it didn't really matter whether this illuminated philosophy or not. It was he did actually say, I think, that he couldn't distinguish it from the kind of linguistics that people in Chicago, I think Chomsky probably, were doing as linguistic scientists at the time. But that is a rather extreme view, and none of us would, I think, nowadays want to suggest that that's all there is to philosophy. At least we'd hope not. But I do think if it isn't the case that all philosophy is philosophy of language, which is the sort of extreme claim I was outlining, we must at least be clear that philosophy needs philosophy of language. Here I'm very aware that I'm sliding between philosophy of language and analytical philosophy and linguistic philosophy, shock horror, and I'm not sure that I can distinguish between them. But linguistic philosophy might be a name for the kind of philosophy which, as I've been outlining Austin, might be thought of as a rather extreme view. Anyway, this is merely an approach that I'm recommending and want to carry through with a few examples later. Of course there are philosophers who wouldn't start from there at all. And believe that metaphysical utterances can have a validity of their own of some kind, but they do this in terms which at least make indicative statements, implying a claim to some sort of truth or validity, as if they were making factual statements, as opposed to metaphor, which we might have liked to have this afternoon, or literature or poetry, which have different kinds of criteria and don't depend on some kind of objective, recognizable, debatable validity. Criticizing poetry is not the same as deciding on alternative philosophical positions. At least I don't believe it is. I think it's evidently a different kind of activity. So if I'm right, it is a good discipline, I think, always to ask how the words in such metaphysical statements are being used. What are the truth conditions implied by their use, or what are the reasons? I was pulled up short on truth conditions. I'm sure Marion will want to do it again, but by a quote in Habermas about Michael Dunnett's piece, "What is the Nature of Causation?" which What is the theory of meaning? I'm getting the wrong quote, which I haven't put in the handout, where Dummett says that there aren't any simple truth conditions for even quite ordinary kinds of statement, like predictions, like counterfactual conditionals, like statements of law. So he replaces, I quote, the knowledge of truth conditions with indirect knowledge, so that one understands an assertoric sentence. Assertoric sentence, anyway, you know what he means. A sentence which is used to make a statement which asserts something, which is what I'm saying philosophy does, as opposed to maybe poetry. When one knows what kind of reasons a speaker would have to cite in order to convince a hearer, we are speaker to hearer again, that the speaker is entitled to raise a truth claim for the sentence. So instead of asking this metaphysical philosopher for truth conditions, I better say he needs to be able to give reasons why anyone should regard his statement as having as raising a truth claim, in the Dummett phrase, or having a stomach, why it should convince the hearer that he is making a truth claim. That is the approach I'm recommending to philosophy, that we should ask always how the concepts are being employed, therefore how the words are to be understood, and what, if possible, is the link with the world, or what reasons can be given for saying that the claimed link with the world is a valid, truthful claim. And that approach, linguistic or analytical or whatever, I would want to hold fast to. And the second part of the talk, that's the key role of language outlined, the second part of the talk is to discuss three areas where I think it needs to be applied, and to stick my neck out a bit on what so far has been extremely general, in order to suggest how I think it might work. The first of these, which we've had before more than once, and you may be bored with, but I still think it's rather essential and crucial. Essential is a good word for it. Namely, the Kripke naming and necessity thesis, that identities between rigid designators, we've had Hesperos and Phosphorus already, but I'm going to do water and H2O, are necessary truths, even though they may have been discovered by scientific investigation a posteriori, and that therefore they reveal something about the essence of what it is to be that thing, or that natural kind of thing, that water, the essence of water, is to be H2O. This seems to me to link with the Kripke definition of rigid designators, where a word or a name, to be a rigid designator, has to pick out the same object or natural kind in every possible counterfactual situation, as the usual saying goes, in every possible world. Then if water and H2O are rigid designators, there's no possible situation in which water turns out not to be H2O. H2O is part of the essence of being water. And this is supposed to be some kind of metaphysical necessity rather than the standard a priori logical necessity, or on the other hand, just an empirical identity. The usual two-world thought experiment, imagine a situation in which water, or whatever, something that looks and behaves like water, turns out not to have a chemical formula H2O. Then it seems to me we would have to decide what to say. Either this stuff is not the kind of water, in which case being H2O is a part of the definition of water, and the identity is an ordinary logical necessity following from the definition, or this is still a peculiar kind of water, and being H2O is not part of the essence of being water after all. So the criterion of being a rigid designator turns out on this view to be the same as being part of a term's definition, and identities are either logical or empirical. Logical necessity, or so to speak, natural necessity, law-like regularity, which eliminates this metaphysical necessity category in between, so I believe. And I'm, although it's, as I said, sticking my neck out and extremely pretentious of me to claim that this particular emperor has rather few garments, I'm at least comforted to see that David Lewis took the same view, as I understand it, in a book whose name I can't now remember. But he said our conventions of language sometimes fix meanings only as a function of matters of contingent fact. He said if the facts are different enough on one dimension, then the meaning which we see as firm on another dimension has a diagonal cut across, and the convention of language which we are operating on, or rather the meaning which we are operating on, may have to be adapted to different matters of fact. Anyway, that's my take, and as I say, I'm rather glad to think that at least David Lewis thought the same, and he also thought that there could be contingent identity statements, which is the other part of Kripke's great metaphysical démarche. But I'm going to move on hastily, before Marion explodes, to the second thing, which I'd like to think more of you, and in particular she will agree with, which is what Frank referred to towards the end of his talk as the sociological turn, where it seems to me that, fine, looking at the sociology of language, even the sociology of philosophical statements, is okay as an empirical exercise in seeing how they may have cropped up out of the society where they appeared. But I think it can blow back at philosophy proper in terms of a kind of relativism of everything depending on the power structure or the language game or something, and therefore remove a proper sense of objectivity and truth, at least as an ideal, as an objective, in the other sense of objective. And the example I want to take on that is Richard Rorty in The Contingency of Language, which is an essay in Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, where he says it's a post-Enlightenment view. Shame. Great scientists invent descriptions of the world which are useful for purposes of predicting and controlling what happens, just as poets and political thinkers invent other descriptions of it for other purposes. But there is no sense in which any of these descriptions is an accurate representation of the way the world is in itself. When the notion of description of the world is moved from the level of criterion-governed sentences within language games to language games as a whole, games which we don't choose by reference to criteria, the idea, he says, the idea that the world decides which descriptions are true can no longer be given a clear sense. The temptation to look for criteria is the result of the temptation to privilege someone among the many languages in which we habitually describe the world or ourselves. And so, in summary, this amounts to saying, I think, I mean, it's slightly difficult to interpret, translate between language games, vocabularies, and so on, but I think it's fair to summarize what he is saying, that there are no meta-criteria by which one basic factual scientific language can be privileged above any other language. The examples he quotes are poetic language or language used by political thinkers. And I think that is a clear-ish representation of a common position, that it depends what you're after, and no one language has any claim to validity beyond any other. I have been inclined to question this. In fact, the change in the print in my handout is because I can't get my machine to translate email back into Word. So this is a bit of an email that that some may have seen before. But I want to argue and see whether anyone agrees that there is a privileging of the basic factual scientific language, namely that we learn language as a tool for making and understanding true factual statements. We learn, that is a table, that this wall is brown, and these are statements which are both true and instructive in how the words are meant to be used, what the language world meaning is. And this is a factual meaning. If I said this wall is puce, it would be mistaken, it would be untrue, and it would fail to teach you the meaning of the word puce. So I would say that learning how to use words to name, classify, describe is learning how to make true statements, learning in effect the truth conditions for those basic factual statements. And those are the links with the world as we experience it, and hence their ways of learning to predict and control the world, which of course is a function of the kind he's picking out. Predicting and controlling is what he says great scientists are involved with. But it seems to me, essential to learning any other use of language, any other of Rorty's languages, does depend on this basic factual language game. And it seems to me pretty evident that no one could learn a language from a poet who was only prepared to talk in metaphors, because precisely a metaphor is using a word which doesn't belong to describe something, but illustrates in some kind of impressionistic fashion instead. And worst of all, imagine trying to learn a language which used only the vocabulary of political philosophers. It wouldn't work. And so it seems to me there is a basic point there. I don't know whether it's linguistic, analytical, or philosophy of language, or what. In a sense, it's more empirical. It's basic child psychology, I suppose. But it seems to me relevant to philosophy of language, particularly if it's used, if there are utterances of the kind that Richard Rorty seems inclined to make in his piece on the contingency of language. Anyway, that's another thesis where I want to be analytical, and it must be said, argue against one current view of the sociological turn as if it is seen as a basis for doing proper philosophy. Then I get to the biggest and vaguest example of all, continental philosophy, which I must say I've always thought shy of for the sort of reasons I was suggesting. It seems to me very heavy going. But I've got a few quotes describing how the continentals see their philosophy, and I think it's worth looking at what they say. The first is Julia Christopher, who is a French, well-known French, distinguished French philosopher, who was doing an interview in The Guardian when I was thinking about all this, and said, "As you know, I belong to the tendency or school in French philosophy which developed in the 60s, in which conceptual work is deeply involved with the personal, and in which notions or ideas are sutured by style," I think that means held together. "There is a lot of imagination, rhetorical figures, subjective expressions, and so on, that often bother the so-called Anglo-Saxon reader, because they consider this French stuff, scare quotes, theory, to be somehow indigestible." Well, maybe we do. Maybe our digestion isn't good enough. But what I want to pick on is that word theory, because I think it does suggest, okay, you can use imagination, rhetorical figures, subjective expressions, and so on, in a work of literature to your heart's content, and people may want to read it and get something out of it in terms of insight or whatever. But that would be a personal view of the world. But the claim that this is theory seems to me to be trying to have it both ways, claiming that the validity is both personal and somehow universal. Theories are what science does rather than what literature does, and they need some kind of objective criteria to validate them, some sort of publicly available empirical backing if there is to be a way of discovering whether it's valid or not, whether one person is doing better than another. And it's the apparent lack of that kind of criterion that I think irritates the Anglo-Saxon reader, irritates his digestion. And it is, of course, very probable that it can be done with greater or lesser cleverness and a greater or lesser length. But it seems, anyway, to an outsider, that one theory tends to be preferred to another if it's more surprising, if it's more paradoxical and harder than ever to penetrate. However, I'm airing my prejudices on this. As I said, Habermas indulges in a good deal of discussion. He's marvellous for having read absolutely everything. He's read Hegel and Fichte and quotes all them with authority. He's also read Grice, Strawson, Austin, Dummett, and quotes them with equal authority, and these French 20th century folk, Derrida and Foucault and whoever else, equally. So I take him a bit on trust, and certainly the language is sometimes their language rather than the clarity of Russell or Auer, but never mind that. He says of another German philosopher, Dieter Heinrich, that his metaphysics takes as its starting point the Kant's and Fichte's theory of self-consciousness, okay, in order then to take up the threefold cord of reconciliation provided by Hegel's phenomenology, good luck him, Hölderlin's hymns, which at least have words in them, and Beethoven's symphonies, most of which don't have words in them. and how he does this, I mean, it sounds a wonderful program, you know, fascinating to see, but you can be sure he does it in very long sentences and polysyllabic words, and presumably there isn't a CD attached to the book. So you're stuck with this kind of verbal discussion of all these apparently incommensurable topics. And the question, therefore, is how do you know if he's done it well? Who's done it better? I am absolutely prepared to admit that people going through this kind of philosophy and having got through pages and pages of it may get some kind of a sense, an insight, or how true. But isn't that a literary rather than a philosophical kind of reward? I think of this as the no gain without pain school of philosophy, where you work very, very hard and then you get to something where you can see that there is some degree of sense. And if it's philosophy, you can probably try to write it down for yourself as approximating to what he seems to have said, and to distill a philosophical position, a recognizable philosophical position, from the words. But in my experience, it's pretty hard going, but also the words, when you get them, are not all that surprising. Or at least, I admit my experience is limited. But if there are such words, then it is an interesting question why they have to be dressed up quite in this style, and why that kind of prose, as I've said, paradoxical and astonishing, is thought to be superior to the sort of Russell, Strawson, limpid clarity where everything is spelled out as exactly and precisely and with deliberate use of language as possible. One more horrendous example from Adorno, where according to Habermas he regarded the striking aphorism as the most appropriate form of presentation. So we get striking aphorisms, alright, some other philosophers do that. capable of expressing in language his secret ideal of knowledge, a Platonistic thought that cannot be expressed, at least not without contradiction. In the medium of speech that gives reasons, can't be expressed in the medium of speech that gives reasons. Knowledge must actually burst the prison of discursive thought and terminate in pure intuition. In plain language, he seems to be claiming that he knows something by pure intuition. He can only express it in contradictory speech and without giving any reasons. But what possible use can that be to anyone else? Sorry, someone is exploding. Understandably. I'm getting to the end. Because I do recognize very clearly that this may seem negative and worse still, old-fashioned in tending to knock down rather than to put up. Though I think the Rorty thing is more negative than I was wanting to be. I want to conclude, therefore, with one each quote from the two books I've been mentioning. Simon Blackburn in a note says, "There's a tantalizing amount of philosophy which consists in balancing images or visions of how things are against one another." And that is a very familiar issue in philosophy, in all kinds of topics within philosophy. He's talking about correspondence against coherence, theories of truth. There are lots of other examples. The external world, where Hume says, when I sit in the study, it seems like one way, and when I go out into the world, it seems quite different. Or free will determinism, where Galen Strawson's book is precisely saying, I'm wholly convinced by determinism, except when I'm actually behaving normally, when I operate according to free will, free choice. And there are a number of others you can give them for yourselves. The mind-body problem, the mind is the brain, against the mind and the brain are different. Causation we had already. I have to accept entirely, agree wholeheartedly that these can't just be dissolved as linguistic muddles or misunderstandings, as positivists Eyre and Coe may have thought. But if I'm right about philosophy being a matter of how best to describe reality, then it surely turns on finding a way of describing what makes us want to say one thing about each of these knotty problems in the clearest possible terms, and then what makes us want to say the other thing. And you could call this metaphysics if you want, but at least it must be clear that language is central to the task. Personally, I like the Habermas label post-metaphysical myself, because it seems to me that this is properly skeptical about metaphysical claims which need to be unpacked to see what makes them valid. And Habermas talks about the humanism of those who continue the Kantian tradition by seeking to use the philosophy of language, which is what we're all about here today, to save a concept of reason which is skeptical and post-metaphysical, yet not defeatist. He says that Hilary Putnam in Reason, Truth, and History, 1981, it takes much the same position. I haven't read that, I reckon to do so, but I hope at least we are outlining a position which focuses on philosophy of language, skeptical about metaphysics, but not just relying on ordinary language in the boring, old-fashioned, negative 1950s Oxford tradition. Thank you. You've got 5 minutes, I think, before the bar opens. Lady, who is explaining?
Thank you, Madam. I do apologise, because it's far more knowledge than I have. Just joining the church about this. But I'm wondering, if the problem isn't, you use that word communication as being very, very good. And I'm wondering if, in some way, because I'm from the arts, therefore I value poetry and fiction, I think that often moves towards traditional music, and that has meanings and works there and so on, and very, very stuff. But actually, if we are tied to interpretation, if we constantly want a what you seem to be implying, the science of language, although want to move away from it as well. And somehow we've got to bridge the gap. I actually do think that the aesthetic experience does in some way, which is possibly after this day, does somehow, emotions are cognitive in some way. And it's probably, of course, apart from entirely from your background.
No, I don't think that's the problem, but I do agree that there is a problem, and the sense of understanding something, getting in touch with reality from, I think music is the best example, arts generally, is, I agree, very prevalent, and I'm honestly not knocking it. I think Beethoven's symphonies are great, and music gives one that sense. But my question, I think, is whether that has much to do with philosophy. Of course, there is a philosophy of aesthetics to try to recognize that and discuss how it operates, what this amounts to. But this is in a factual way. This is a descriptive way rather than how it hits you.
But isn't that the problem, actually, that perhaps as literature, I mean, kind of read description of that, it's a different kind of description of that, and it works, but what you want to see is to focus on factual.
I wouldn't quite accept factual, analyzable language is what I'm after.
I think all I can say is mitigate, you know, God guarding from the thoughts and instincts in the mind alone.
Okay.
As you know, the rest of it, which is he that thinks in the narrow bone, I do think sensibility and aesthetic is very much coming to thought, rational thought as well.
That it exists, I agree, is a fact.
We do have a discussion session this afternoon. I've got four people on the list. I think we'll run a bit past 12:15. I think we've got enough time, but I just think the four I've already got on the list.
I'm just going to lay down
markers
for this afternoon. First, I agree with Alan about everything he said about continental philosophy, etc. And the lady who's just spoken is quite right about this, the importance of aesthetics and literature, but it's a completely separate domain from philosophy, and the understanding you get from the art is nothing like it. It's a different sort of understanding than the understanding you're trying to get from philosophy. But I want to get you on quickly, because I feel that you've conflated two key arguments that Christine has made. People accuse quickly of conflating semantics and metaphysics. He doesn't, but the people who talk about him frequently do. Now, I can't go into this now. I think what I'd like is this afternoon, Marianne, who's probably been puffing and blowing in some way. Because Marianne's got more experience in explaining GC very quickly, and then I will take a second as well.
I crept your hand out for it, but I may well have misunderstood it. Next question.
I want to talk about the critique section as well, but in a completely different light. I mean, I felt it betrays the positivist influence very strongly. He seemed to say, almost explicitly, he did say that only a priori analytical or a posteriori empirical claim of validity. So, I mean, it's a pity you weren't at Kant weekend, but I mean, what that basically says is that Kant is a priori, is a non-existent area, and therefore Kant's critique, I think mine as well, is metaphysics is impossible. That was going to be my question, but you then, at the end, appear to want to say that metaphysics is possible. And from many discussions I've like had, you appear to me to think that it is.
Well, perhaps there is something, Carrick, I admit. But what I was trying to say at the end is that there are difficult, complex questions, whereas Blackburn says there is a tension to apply one vision image to the subject and an opposite inclination to apply another picture, which are the pictures are incompatible. But it seems to me, I mean, you can call that sort of discussion metaphysics if you like, but it seems to me that the valuable approach, which people do more or less, and I'm not sure about Kant, a long time since I read him and I ducked in the weekend, okay, but the valuable approach is surely to look at what makes us say one thing and try to be as clear as possible about our reasons for that. Dummy reasons are better than truth conditions, as the way in which we learn to link that language of the world, and what are our reasons for wanting to apply the other picture. And that may be a metaphysical discussion, but it doesn't seem to me to require metaphysical entities. What it requires is an understanding of the way the world is, which is complex and hard to untangle.
I would accept that it doesn't require metaphysical entities, but do you think it's possible to investigate the mind with something like the free will problem, for example, with only a priori or empirical consideration?
Yes, I do. The piece I wrote in the Philosophical Review was trying to do just that, and you said it came to a juddering halt and didn't convince you. Yes.
Did you believe in religion?
Sorry?
Do you
Yes, if you define them clearly and use it in the way you define them.
You know that sugar,
I think Eileen's shaking her head and wanting to discuss this afternoon.
Yeah, let's pick that up after lunch. If I can just take two, John, your first.
In the last paragraph of your book, where philosophy is, there is much of what they are at the new millennium.
Yeah.
But a woman who says, thank heavens at last, we're getting away from the dominance of the philosophy of language, which has dominated philosophy in England for the last 30 years. Thank God we're now returning to the position where we can address the real problems of philosophy, which are metaphysical.
Well, I understand that view. And I did back off from claiming philosophy of language was the only kind of philosophy, to saying that all philosophy needs philosophy of language, if I'm allowed to use that as analytical philosophy, an equivalent analytical philosophy, in order to see what is, in the clearest possible terms, what is being asserted. Because even the most metaphysical philosophy, partly the lady who thinks music does, the music is possible. I mean, I'm putting the musical thing on one, the aesthetic thing on one side. That all philosophy is aiming to make some kind of assertion, and it needs to be unpacked.
What does metaphysical mean?
Well, it's his label, good long, no doubt German word, for getting beyond the kind of metaphysical philosophy that no doubt all the Germans were brought up on, where you don't have to ask, you know, what is the idea of capital I and right law or whatever. You don't have to unpack these notions. You just use them as counters in a great game, because other people have used them, and you're building on other people for somebody it was saying. Sorry, I'm caricaturing, but I think that is why. Good luck to him. He wants to be a bit post metaphysical.
Simon has a question. Peter seems very urgent. I know Peter's got to stop this afternoon, but can you wait for this afternoon? Let's have Simon. He's got a question.
In principle, do you think that if you can't say something clearly, you really aren't saying it, you've just got to keep trying? Or do you think there are genuinely some conditions in which only a sort of verbally factory round numbers of responses? This thing people say, I know what you know, what to say, but I can't say. Are there some things that
genuinely the case? Fair question, and I bracket that bit of Tractatus along with the logical positivist. What can be said at all can be said clearly is not a position I would reckon to take. And the Blackburn quote about tensions would be one way of pointing out the fact that, of course, not all meaning is, I mean, we have Frank about meaning and determinacy, not all meaning is determinate, even water. And so I'm not saying what can be said at all can be said clearly, but I think what I would say is that the purpose of philosophy is to say as clearly as possible what can be said.
Can I just close off at this stage? We will be meeting again after lunch, so the people will be doing the session there, and we've got actually quite an extended discussion session. But thanks very much.